I snuck in the ages of the poets in our readings, just to point out that if you're an Indigenous American, it takes you a lot longer to be named Poet Laureate than if you're a white male. Hopefully we're making some progress there, because Joy was finally recognized. And both of them contributed to the sermon. And I have to say, I have a lot of help at various stages in my sermon writing. All week long, for instance, I pepper Michelle, my wife, with questions that land out of the blue for her. Things like, does Hebrew have a word for spiritual growth? When our parents were dying and they started saying things that you knew were wrong, can you remember what made you decide whether to say nothing, play along, or contradict them? Do you know any children's books about dancing angels? Sometimes she inquires why I'm asking. Usually, though, she simply answers and lets me continue with my train of thought, feeling no particular need or desire to climb aboard. Every now and then, remarkably rarely, to be honest, because I'm very fortunate to be married to her, every now and then, she ignores my question and lets me know that she was thinking about or doing something that I shouldn't have impulsively interrupted. By Friday morning, though, my dog Pan takes over as my major helper. I head up to my desk with my coffee to fire up the computer. And at this time of year, I drape my lap with a blanket because my desk happens to be in a corner with two windows nearby and not enough heat. And Pan picks up a chew toy from the ones that are lying around the living room and follows me upstairs. He brushes up against me for a pat, and then he settles down on the hooked rug that my grandmother made. I begin typing and cutting and pasting, and every now and then, Pan gets up to stretch, come over and get petted again. Perhaps he leaves the room to make a quick surveillance tour of the house to see if everything's okay. Then he comes back and he lies down on the rug again. So this helps me refocus my thinking if I've been wandering. For instance, he calls me back to what I'm supposed to be doing if I've made a brief trip out onto the internet to check some fact or whatever, and I've gotten caught listening to indie music acts on the Tiny Desk Concerts on the NPR website. A bottomless pit of entertainment for me. Then, about 90 minutes or 2 hours into the sermon writing routine, if Michelle hasn't called him to take him to the dog park or for a walk outside, Pan gets up and he comes over and he starts insistently bumping my arm away from the keyboard, pausing only to bark or spin around in time to play circles. There's nothing to do for it at that point but to take him for a walk. I usually head out into the meadows and the woods where I can safely let Pan wander and run. And it's really remarkable how often the final form and flow of the sermon begins to come together out there during that walk. Now, I think this process is closely related to what Joy Harjo described in the opening lines to her poem, Eagle Song. To pray, you open your whole self to sky, to earth, to sun, to moon, to one whole voice that is you. And know there is more that you can't see, can't hear, can't know, except in moments steadily growing, and in languages that aren't always sound, but other circles of motion. Pan's language, when it's time to walk, includes literal circles of motion. He's got that shepherd spin around, let's time to play thing. But figuratively, what he's doing is a demand for acceptance, and it's an invitation to me for spiritual growth outside of writing. A time to open myself up, for instance, to prayer as a vehicle for growth. There's a good argument, I believe, that prayer is one way to plead for spiritual growth. Prayer might be asking for that liberating growth of forgiveness that becomes possible in the wake of sincere confessions of one's failures. That's one thing people do when they pray. It might be asking to grow through practicing faith in the positive impact of compassion for someone else's suffering and misfortune. That's another thing we do when we pray. We ask for relief for those we know are suffering. It might be seeking the growth of deeper connection to the ways of gratitude that save us from despair. A lot of prayers are about thank you. But prayer isn't the only way, the only path to spiritual growth that calls us towards opening our whole selves. Our spirit is steadily growing in languages that, in Harjo's exquisite words, aren't always sound, but other circles of motion. Our third principle affirms that deep acceptance of one another in our congregations is a circle of motion in this sense. And thinking about that, I wondered, what are we circling around? Now, those of you who know me won't be too surprised at this turn of my contemplation. You may well recall from past sermons and small group check-ins that one of my favorite poems by Rainer Maria Rilke begins, "I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may not complete the last one, but I give myself to it." And Rilke's answer to what he was circling around, as translated from the original German by Joanna Macy and Anita Barrows, is, "I circle around God, around the primordial tower I've been circling for thousands of years, and I still don't know. Am I a falcon, a storm, or a great song?" Rilke's uncertainty about his own nature extends to who we are collectively. Through our relationships to all humans, we have been circling our visions of the sacred, creative forces in the universe for thousands of years. I've spent enough time as and with other UU atheists to consider another possibility. Perhaps the metaphor of circling is a comforting self-deception, a way of staving off feelings of being lost and insignificant. The truth is that we appear briefly in this universe. We die. Our elements are redistributed into everything else that succeeds us. That's not circling, that's recycling. It's also a truth that strikes me as simplistic, boring, and not worthy of our time as living beings. It suggests a pointlessness to life and most of what we UUs care about, like, just to throw out a random example, leaving a healthy, habitable planet to future generations of humans and millions of other species that we are currently busy wiping out. So let's return to a point of view that feeds us spiritually. Consider the aims of prayer I mentioned a few moments ago: forgiveness, compassion, gratitude. Some might say dismissively that these are all just subjective feelings rooted in biology and honed by culture. But feelings are to be prized and explored, not explained away. I invite you then to picture a Venn diagram where forgiveness, compassion, and gratitude overlap. And that holy meeting place in the center of those three might have a variety of names, but in English, the most comprehensive is probably conscience. Conscience. Now, I'm aware that it's been said that an untroubled conscience is no more than a sign of a poor memory. But we still ought to be seeking to move in that direction. If our atheists and secular humanists want something stripped of God language and other spirit talk to picture what we mean in the third principle when we speak of encouraging spiritual growth, I propose that we name it as an expanding sense of conscience we heed in ways that affirm and promote our seven principles. An expanding sense of conscience we heed in ways that affirm and promote our seven principles. I'd like to go a little further this morning, though, in my search for some common ground across the wide range of beliefs I know are in this room this morning. And to get there, I want to take you back to President Abraham Lincoln's first inaugural address. You didn't see that coming, did you? Remember that Lincoln faced divisions, fears, and hostility on a scale that makes our current depressing political scene look mild in most respects. We were still a young nation when he was writing that inaugural address. Citizens included elderly survivors of the Revolution, people who'd been alive when the Constitution and Bill of Rights were adopted, veterans of the War of 1812 that preserved the nation's independence. But as he sat down to write, seven states had seceded from the Union between November 6th, when he was elected, and March 4th, 1861, when he took the oath of office and delivered the address. Now, Lincoln had steadfastly said nothing about the South or slavery during those months. He wanted to avoid inflaming matters further. He wrote his inauguration address in tight secrecy. His train ride from Illinois to Washington took him through several northern cities, and he made some public appearances, but he spoke in very vague terms to the welcoming crowds. And he traveled the final leg of that journey to Washington through slaveholding Maryland in the dead of night in a heavily guarded railroad car because there had been rumors of a plan to assassinate him before he even took office. Now, the speech made it absolutely clear he had no intention of trying to impede slavery in states where it was legal. Indeed, he promised to enforce fugitive slave laws that required Northerners to return people who had escaped enslavement to those who claimed to own them or their agents. And the inaugural address ended with the words, "We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell with the chorus of union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." Well, this, of course, was a triumph of hope and prayer over what happened, at least what happened in the short term. But I want to return to that phrase, better angels. Lincoln did not coin the phrase better angels. There are, for instance, examples of that phrase used to name what is best in us, dating all the way back to Shakespeare. And Shakespeare probably got them from someone else. But the phrase had never been widely used. And Lincoln specifically wrote in the term to replace a draft of the speech which his trusted supporter William Seward had proposed and which called on the nation's guardian angel to lead us through. I'm with Lincoln on this one. I think it is fruitless and dangerous to envision some external divine angel pulling us through disasters as a nation or individuals. But better angels of our own nature, that's another matter. In his typical satirical but affectionate manner, Billy Collins takes us there in his poem, Questions About Angels. Collins takes off on a flight of fancy from a common myth, the myth that medieval scholars hotly debated whether angels had physical presences that affected how many could dance on the head of a pin. There's actually no record of medieval scholars debating this. In doing so, Collins plays with lots of images of what angels might be and how they might appear to us. I love particularly the stanza where he says, "Do they fly through God's body and come out singing? Do they swing like children from the hinges of the spirit world, saying their names backwards and forwards? Do they sit alone in little gardens changing colors?" He sneaks in a serious question or two. Can the angelic entities look over the fence and see hell? And then he kind of moseys up to a provocative hypothesis. The images we have of angelic hosts in billions, they're not reflections of a human belief in some almighty God's power. They're a distraction from how simple any angel calling us to a better world must be. His suggestion of the angel calling us to a better world is a beautiful young female dancing forever in stocking feet, always, it seems, with an ambiguously human jazz band playing in the background, aware that it's getting very late even for musicians. I want to leave you with a suggestion that your conscience may be inviting you to acceptance of one another and spiritual growth, and that this is a good place, this sanctuary is a good place to connect with that impulse. But another way to think about it that I find more compelling than that strict view of the human conscience is the image of one simple, beautiful angel. This angel, whose pronouns, by the way, are they, thee, and them, is a messenger for my better angels. I don't know about you, but I'm sure my better angels are serious, but not without their desires and quirks. They are reminding me to let life be a dance, even when the hour is late. We need our pleasures, our rest, and to do what must be done to make the world better while there is time. Now, there's one other appeal for me in this image. I'm pretty sure that if Pan were to see it on a walk, he'd bark enthusiastically and be anxious to get a good whiff of it. I can't say the idea of human conscience would be nearly as attractive. Better angels might be what the human conscience wants to be when it grows up spiritually. So we departed from the order of service by doing some pathways to connection at the beginning, and I won't repeat them, but I will invite you to go back and look closely. There's the opportunity for the walk that Mike is hosting. Mike, raise your hand, Mike and Liam, so people know who they'd be walking with if they don't know you yet. And there is the opportunity to join with some people from the other churches that are sponsoring the solar field at 10 a.m. And I invite you to think about those activities this Saturday, as well as any of the other things that would make your season wonderful. And show up Sunday for a really wonderful solstice, Hanukkah, looking forward to Christmas service.